Chapter 15. We woke late the next morning, and at Harris's earnest desire partook of a plain breakfast with non-dainties. Then we cleaned up and put everything straight. A continual labour, which was beginning to afford me a pretty clear insight into the question that had often posed me, namely, how a woman with the work of only one house on her hands manages to pass away her time, and at about 10 o'clock set out on what we had determined should be a good day's journey. We agreed that we would pull this morning as a change from towing, and Harris thought the best arrangement would be that George and I should scull and he steer. I did not chime in with this idea at all. I said that Harris would have been showing a more proper spirit if he had suggested that he and George should work and let me rest a bit. It seemed to me that I was doing more than my fair share of the work on this trip, and I was beginning to feel strongly on the subject. It always does seem to me that I am doing more work than I should. It's not that I object to work, mind you. I like work. It fascinates me. I can sit and look at it for hours. I love to keep it by me. The idea of getting rid of it nearly breaks my heart. You cannot give me too much work. To accumulate work has almost become a passion with me. My study is so full of it now that there's hardly an inch of room for any more. I shall have to throw out a wing soon. And I'm careful of my work, too. Why, some of the work that I have by me now has been in my possession for years and years. There isn't a finger mark on it. I take a great pride in my work. I take it down now and then and dust it. No man keeps his work in a better state of preservation than I do. But though I crave for work, I still like to be fair. I do not ask for more than my proper share. But I get it without asking for it, at least so it appears to me, and this worries me. George says he does not think I need trouble myself on the subject. He thinks that it is only my over-scrupulous nature that makes me fear I am having more than my due, and that, as a matter of fact, I don't have half as much as I ought. But I expect he only says that to comfort me. In a boat, I've always noticed that it is the fixed idea of each member of the crew that he is doing everything. Harris's notion was that it was he alone who had been working, and that both George and I had been imposing upon him. George, on the other hand, ridiculed the idea of Harris's having done anything more than eat and sleep, and had a cast-iron opinion that it was he, George himself, who had done all the labour worth speaking of. He said he'd never been out with such a couple of lazily skulks as Harris and I. That amused Harris. "Fancy old George talking about work," he laughed. "Why, half an hour of it would kill him. Have you ever seen George work?" he added, turning to me. I agreed with Harris that I never had, most certainly not since we had started on this trip. "Well, I don't see how you can know so much about it one way or the other," George retorted on Harris. "For I'm blessed if you haven't been asleep half the time. Have you ever seen Harris fully awake, except at mealtime?" asked George, addressing me. Truth compelled me to support George. Harris had been very little good in the boat, so far as helping was concerned, from the beginning. "Well, hang it all. I've done more than old Jay, anyhow," rejoined Harris. "Well, you couldn't very well have done less," added George. "I suppose Jay thinks he is the passenger," continued Harris. And that was their gratitude to me for having brought them and their wretched old boat all the way up from Kingston, and for having superintended and managed everything for them, and taken care of them, and slaved for them. It is the way of the world. We settled the present difficulty by arranging that Harris and George should scull up past Reading, and that I should tow the boat on from there. Pulling a heavy boat against a strong stream has few attractions for me now. There was a time, long ago, when I used to clamour for the hard work. Now I like to give the youngsters a chance. I notice that most of the old river hands are similarly retiring whenever there's any stiff pulling to be done. You can always tell an old river hand by the way in which he stretches himself out upon the cushions on the bottom of a boat and encourages the rowers to tell them anecdotes about the marvellous feats he performed last season. "Call what you're doing hard work," he drawls. between contented whiffs, addressing the two perspiring novices who have been grinding away steadily upstream for the last hour and a half. Why, Jim, Biffles, and Jack and I last season pulled up from Marlow to Goringham one afternoon, never stopped once. Do you remember that, Jack? Jack, who has made himself a bed on the prow of all the rugs and coats he can collect, and who has been lying there asleep for the last 2 hours, partially wakes up on being thus appealed to, and recollects all about the matter, and also remembers that there was an unusually strong stream against them all the way, likewise a stiff wind. "About 34 miles, I suppose it must have been," adds the first speaker, reaching down another cushion to put under his head. "No, no, don't exaggerate, Tom," murmurs Jack reprovingly. 33 at the outside. And Jack and Tom, quite exhausted by this conversational effort, dropped off to sleep once more. And the two simple-minded youngsters at the Skulls feel quite proud of being allowed to row such wonderful oarsmen as Jack and Tom and strain away harder than ever. When I was a young man, I used to listen to these tales from my elders and take them in and swallow them and digest every word of them and then come up for more. But the new generation do not seem to have the simple faith of the old times. We, George, Harris, and myself, took a raw one up with us last season, and we plied him with the customary stretches about the wonderful things we had done all the way up. We gave him all the regular ones, the time-honoured lies that have done duty upriver with every boating man for years past, and added 7 entirely original ones that we'd invented for ourselves, including a really quite likely story founded to a certain extent on an all-but-true episode, which had actually happened in a modified degree some years ago to friends of ours, a story that a mere child could have believed without injuring himself much. And that young man mocked at them all, and wanted us to repeat the feats then and there, and to bet us 10 to 1 that we didn't. We got to chatting about our rowing experiences this morning, and to recounting stories of our first efforts in the art of oarsmanship. My own earliest boating recollection is of 5 of us, contributing 3 each and taking out a curiously constructed craft on Regent's Park Lake, drying ourselves, subsequently, in the park keeper's lodge. I devoted some 3 months to rafting, and being then as proficient as there was any need to be at that branch of the art, I determined to go for rowing proper, and joined one of the Lee boating clubs. Being out in a boat on the River Lee, especially on Saturday afternoons, soon makes you smart at handling a craft, and spry at escaping being run down by roughs and swamped by bargees. It also offers plenty of opportunities for acquiring the most prompt and graceful method of lying down flat at the bottom of the boat so as to avoid being chucked out into the river by passing tow lines. But it does not give you style. It was not until I came to the Thames that I got style. My style of rowing is very much admired now. People say it is so quaint. George never went near the water until he was 16. Then he and 8 other gentlemen of about the same age went down in a body to Kew one Saturday, with the idea of hiring a boat there and pulling to Richmond and back. One of their number, a shock-haired youth named Joskins, who had once or twice taken out a boat on the Serpentine, told them it was jolly fun boating. The tide was running out pretty rapidly when they reached the landing stage, and there was a stiff breeze blowing across the river, but this did not trouble them at all, and they proceeded to select their boat. There was an 8-oared racing outrigger drawn up on the stage. That was the one that took their fancy. They said they'd have that one, please. The boatman was away, and only his boy was in charge. The boy tried to dampen their ardour for the outrigger and showed them 2 or 3 very comfortable-looking boats of the family party build. But those would not do at all. The outrigger was the boat they thought they would look best in. So the boy launched it, and they took off their coats and prepared to take their seats. The boys suggested that George, who even in those days was always the heavy man of any party, should be number 4. George said he should be happy to be number 4, and promptly stepped into the bow's place, and sat down with his back to the stern. They got him into the proper position at last, and then the others followed. A particularly nervous boy was appointed Cox, and the steering principle explained to him by Joskins. Joskins himself took stroke. He told the others that it was simple enough. All they had to do was follow him. They said they were ready, and the boy on the landing stage took a boat hook and shoved him off. What then followed, George is unable to describe in detail. He has a confused recollection of having, immediately on starting, received a violent blow in the small of his back from the butt end of number 5's skull, at the same time that his own seat seemed to disappear from him by magic and leave him sitting on the boards. He also noticed, as a curious circumstance, that number 2 was at the same instant lying on his back at the bottom of the boat, with his legs in the air, apparently in a fit. They passed under Kew Bridge, broadside, at the rate of 8 miles an hour, Joskins being the only one who was rowing. George, on recovering his seat, tried to help him, but on dipping his oar in the water, immediate to his intense surprise, disappeared under the boat and nearly took him with it. And then Cox threw both rudder lines overboard and burst into tears. How they got back, George never knew, but it took them just 40 minutes. A dense crowd watched the entertainment from Kew Bridge with much interest, and everybody shouted to them different directions. 3 times they managed to get the boat back through the arch, and 3 times they were carried under it again, and every time Cox looked up and saw the bridge above him, he broke out into renewed sobs. George said he little thought that afternoon that he should ever come to really like boating. Harris is more accustomed to sea rowing than to river work, and says that, as an exercise, he prefers it. I don't. I remember taking a small boat out at Eastbourne last summer. I used to do a good deal of sea rowing years ago, and I thought I should be all right, but I'd found I'd forgotten the art entirely. When one scull was deep down underneath the water, the other would be flourishing wildly about in the air. To get a grip of the water with both at the same time, I had to stand up. The parade was crowded with nobility and gentry, and I had to pull past them in this ridiculous fashion. I landed halfway down the beach and secured the services of an old boatman to take me back. I like to watch old boatmen rowing, especially one who has been hired by the hour. There is something so beautifully calm and restful about his method. It is so free from that fretful haste, that vehement striving that is every day becoming more and more the bane of 19th-century life. He is not forever straining himself to pass all the other boats. If another boat overtakes him and passes him, it does not annoy him. As a matter of fact, they all do overtake and pass him, all those that are going his way. This would trouble and irritate some people. The sublime equanimity of the hired boatman under the ordeal affords us a beautiful lesson against ambition and uppishness. George said he had often longed to take to punting for a change. Punting is not as easy as it looks. As in rowing, you soon learn to get along and handle the craft, but it takes long practice before you can do this with dignity and without getting water all up your sleeve. A young man I knew had a very sad accident happen to him the first time he went punting. He'd been getting on so well that he'd grown quite cheeky over the business, and was walking up and down the punt, working his pole with a careless grace that was quite fascinating to watch. Up he would march to the head of the punt, plant his pole, and then run right down to the other side, just like an old punter. Oh, it was grand. And it would all have gone on being grand, if he had not unfortunately, while looking round to enjoy the scenery, taken just one step more than there was any necessity for, and walked off the punt altogether. The pole was fixed firmly in the mud, and he was left clinging to it while the punt drifted away. It was an undignified position for him. A rude boy on the bank immediately yelled out to the lagging chum to hurry up and see a real monkey on a stick. I could not go to his assistance because, as ill luck would have it, we had not taken the proper precaution to bring out a spare pole with us. I could only sit back and look at him. His expression as the pole slowly sank with him, I shall never forget. There was so much thought in it. I watched him gently let down into the water and saw him scramble out, sad and wet. I could not help laughing. He looked such a ridiculous figure. I continued to chuckle to myself about it for some time, and then it was suddenly forced in upon me that really I had got very little to laugh at when I came to think of it. Here was I, alone in a punt, without a pole, drifting helplessly down midstream, possibly towards a weir. I began to feel very indignant with my friend for having stepped overboard and gone off in that way. He might at all events have left me the pole. I drifted on for about a quarter of a mile, and then I came in sight of a fishing punt moored in midstream, in which sat two old fishermen. They saw me bearing down upon them, and they called out to me to keep out of their way. "I can't," I shouted back. "But you don't try," they answered. I explained the matter to them when I got nearer, and they caught me and led me a pole. The weir was just 50 yards below. I'm glad they happened to be there. Sailing is a thing that wants knowledge and practice too, though as a boy I did not think so. I had an idea that it came natural to a body like rounders and touch. I knew another boy who held this view likewise, and so one windy day we thought we would try the sport. We were stopping down at Yarmouth, and we decided we would go for a trip up the Yar. We hired a sailing boat at the yard by the bridge and started off. "It's rather a rough day," said the man to us as we put off. "Better take a reef and luff sharp when you get round the bend." We said we would make a point of it, and left him with a cheery "good morning," wondering to ourselves how you luffed, and where we were to get a reef from, and what we were to do with it when we got it. We rowed on until we were out of sight of the town, and then, with a wide stretch of the water in front of us and the wind blowing a perfect hurricane across it, we felt the time had come to commence operations. Hector, I think that was his name, went on pulling while I unrolled the sail. It seemed a complicated job, but I accomplished it at length, and then came the question, which was the top end? By a sort of natural instinct, we of course eventually decided that the bottom was the top, and set to work to fix it upside down. But it was a long time before we could get it up, either that way or any other way. The impression on the mind of the sail seemed to be that we were playing at funerals, and that I was the corpse and itself was the winding sheet. When it found that this was not the idea, it hit me over the head with the boom and refused to do anything. "Wet it," said Hector. "Drop it over and get it wet." He said people in ships always wetted the sails before they put them up. So I wetted it, but that only made matters worse than they were before. A dry sail clinging to your legs and wrapping itself round your head is not pleasant, but when the sail is sopping wet, it becomes quite vexing. We did get the thing up at last, the two of us together. We fixed it, not exactly upside down, more sideways-like, and we tied it up to the mast with the painter, which we cut off for the purpose. That the boat did not upset, I simply state as a fact. Why it did not upset, I am unable to offer any reason. Possibly the result may have been brought about by the natural obstinacy of all things in this world. The boat may possibly have come to the conclusion, judging from a cursory view of our behaviour, that we had come out for a morning suicide, and thereupon determined to disappoint us. That is the only suggestion I can offer. By clinging like grim death to the gunwale, we just managed to keep inside the boat, but it was exhausting work. Hector said that pirates and other seafaring people generally lashed the rudder to something or other, and hauled in the main top jib during severe squalls, and thought we ought to try something of that kind. But I was for letting her have a head to the wind. As my advice was by far the easiest to follow, we ended up by adopting it, and contrived to embrace the gunwale to give her her head. The boat travelled upstream for about a mile at a pace I have never sailed at since, and don't want to again. Then, at a bend, she heeled over till half her sail was under the water. Then she righted herself by a miracle, and flew for a long, low bank of soft mud. That mud bank saved us. The boat ploughed its way into the middle of it, and then stuck. Finding that we were once more able to move according to our ideas, instead of being pitched and thrown about like peas in a bladder, we crept forward and cut down the sail. We had had enough sailing. We did not want to overdo the thing and get a surfeit of it. We had had a sail, a good all-round, exciting, interesting sail, and now we thought we would just have a row, just for a change, like. We took the sculls and tried to push the boat off the mud, and in doing so we broke one of the sculls. After that we proceeded with great caution. But they were a wretched old pair, and the second one cracked almost easier than the first, and left us helpless. The mud stretched out for about 100 yards in front of us, and behind us was the water. The only thing to do was to sit and wait until someone came by. It was not the sort of day to attract people out on the river, and it was 3 hours before a soul came in sight. It was an old fisherman, who, with immense difficulty, at last rescued us, and we were towed back in an ignominious fashion to the boatyard. What between tipping the man who had brought us home, and paying for the broken skulls, and for having been out 4 hours and a half, it cost us a pretty considerable number of weeks' pocket money, that sail. But we learned experience, as they say, and that is always cheap at any price.